Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabbit.
Good morning, good morning. And here we are. We're very au courant this morning.
We are, and we're dealing with culinary personalities. Yeah, but
let's deal with the au courant, first of all, because those of you who read this morning's paper, this is the day we're recording this program, would have read an interesting story for restaurant fans that Gordon Ramsay, the illustrious one, he's opening a new restaurant close to a new restaurant that Jamie Oliver is involved in, another illustrious one, both near St. Paul's Cathedral. It turns out that Jamie Oliver's partner in his place is an American called Adam Perry Lang. And guess who's our first guest on the program?
Right.
Talking about something a little different than owning a restaurant, but interesting nevertheless.
Adam Perry Lang, I was going along happily thinking you were English for some reason, and then finally got the connection. You are American, Brooklyn born.
That's right.
CIA grad, France trained, I guess I should say. But you're popping back and forth between New York and London.
For reasons we'll get to later.
Yeah, we'll get to it. First, we want to talk about how you became, with all this background, culinary background, how you became a barbecue expert and essentially a pit master.
Go on. How did this happen?
Oh, how did I become a pit master?
Yeah.
I'm just having trouble with that word pit master, quite frankly, because, you know, mastery is a lifelong journey. So, I mean, I am just someone who kind of plays with fire, I guess you could say.
It's really funny, Adam. Our son, Adam, your namesake, called me 2 weeks ago around dinner time and said, "Dad, I finally did it. I cooked the perfect burger, just like you tried to explain it to me."
Yeah, what is there to do after you quote unquote master? I just think it's a term that's kind of, you know, respectful. I know people like the label, but you know, it's just a term that's kind of just banged around quite a lot. And you know, there's so many people that have been doing it for so many years that I think that we're all just on this journey, and the convergence is all really what it's about.
But your book, BBQ 25, has 25 no-fail recipes
yep.
with pictorial and written instructions.
And it's a board book.
Yes.
Wipeable, windproof. I mean, that's the concept. It's kind of like a Boy Scout's guide to the, you know, the outdoors in the barbecue format.
But there's some real secrets in here, aren't there?
Yeah, you know what? It's my whole concept behind cooking barbecue and what I distilled in here. And, you know, there's nothing in this book that's dumbed down. I call it, it's a distillation. It's basically the 25 recipes people cook, and I cook myself 95% of the time. You know, so for me, it really has been, and we all do rubs and base and all these different types of things, but how do I make these flavors 3D? And that's really what I kind of, which is a phrase that I coined.
Yeah, explain that to me, because in the book, the comments about your book, they say that you are an expert at layering flavors.
Right. You know what? It really comes down to making certain things pop and using sometimes common ingredients in uncommon ways to make it pop. For example, I'll take yellow ballpark mustard and beef bouillon cube and incorporate that into a spice paste, and it would really bring out the flavor of the beef when it's cooked directly on the grill. It just intensifies it. You know, that's an example of 3D flavor. Or I might take Greek yogurt and papaya and use it in a marinade, similar to like a tandoor chicken on a chicken type recipe, and as a result it comes out tender, the flavors really kind of get really inside of it. It just basically pop.
Now you said, in one section you say oil, do not use olive oil.
Right.
And why is that?
You don't use olive oil on the grill for, I'd say, two reasons, but I'm sure I can probably come up with more. First of all, it has a low burn point. Okay. Second, any nuances that you might experience in what olive oil is chosen for are completely burned off and destroyed in the process.
I
prefer to use a vegetable or canola oil because it doesn't glaze over the grill. I don't know if those of you have tried it that experienced that. So not only is it a waste of money, it's really ineffective, and it can give off flavors and bitter flavors.
Yeah. Oh, see,
that's for the grill. I mean, in marinades, you can use the olive oil, but you always need to have a clean, well-oiled grill, and the well-oiled part is from vegetable oil, right?
All right. I didn't realize that.
It's as much as anything else in grill preparation.
Right.
Yeah, I'd love you you sort of handwrite, or I mean, it's supposed to look like handwriting.
Yep.
These little, I don't know, whimsical things like boneless beef roast, and you have a photograph of it, and photograph the herbs, and then you write festive in red. And then you have baby back ribs, you write primal.
Right.
What prompted this?
I think that there's certain recipes that can be, and again, you know, this gets back to the point that these are distilled recipes. These are the real deal. There's nothing held back. And even in that distillation, in terms of what do these pictures and what do these cuts really elicit and form? Well, in my mind, for example, like say the pork chops, super tasty. I mean, you really get a punch of flavor, or you try the pork tenderloin and it's rustic. So it's really just kind of like, as you're glancing through something, you know, sometimes we don't need to read the whole chapter to make our decision.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes we take a look and, hey, I want something foolproof, and you just take a look at the chicken breast and bone and thighs, and that's really what it is.
But you haven't explained how you got from really haute culinary to barbecue.
Well, I mean, it's been a quite interesting journey. I appreciate, like so many people do, you know, high-end classical cuisine. But for me, first and foremost, I knew that no matter how hard I worked, I'd never be a French chef because I'm not French. but also, I had a love for all different types of cuisine. And for me, cooking with fire was really interesting when the entire industry started going towards sous vide and vacuum packaging and you know, instant, you know, long cook methods. And I mean, these things are very interesting and they're great for understanding cooking, but in reality it really takes the guts out of the process. I found that when you cook outdoors and you do barbecue, the difference between that and cooking in a kitchen, you just turn a knob and bang, you have medium heat or you have a 350-degree oven. In barbecue, you really have to work for it and be outdoors and be part of it. And for me, that was where all the excitement started.
So you're a real throwback in a way.
I guess so, or maybe I'm trying to bring back. I'm just taking a look at a lot of these cooks in the kitchen, and at first it's so gratifying to cook something perfectly, almost electronically, but it gets boring, and these guys, these kids, these people are going in there and saying, what did I spend tens of thousands of dollars on my culinary education if I'm essentially pushing a button? It gets tired fast.
I see what you mean. So you brought this barbecue style to a restaurant in New York City.
That's correct.
That's the first step, and that's called Daisy...
Daisy Mays Barbecue, and it's on 46th Street and 11th Avenue.
And then you decided to really decided on a great leap of faith and decided to open a restaurant in London.
That's right.
Go explain that one.
Wow, I mean, it just kind of happened. Jamie and I were introduced to one another through our mutual publisher.
That's Jamie Oliver.
Yeah, Jamie and Oliver and I were met through our mutual publisher, who said that we had to meet, we're so much alike. And I'm like, great, I've been a huge fan of Jamie's since I started out as a chef at this place called Manzu down in Manhattan.
Oh, you were at Manzu.
Yeah, I was a chef there. And you remember it?
Yeah, years ago.
Oh, yeah.
It's been closed a while, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah, a long time ago. And I used to go home late at night, and my wife and I, we would watch it at the base of our feet. We had our TV on a wine crate, and we'd watch The Naked Chef, and it was just like so entertaining. And I said, this guy is cooking the food that I want to eat. Anyway, tucked away for a while, I go ahead and I meet him. We hit it off. He came in for dinner at Daisy Mays at like 7 o'clock. Turns around, it's like 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. And ever since then, you know, we've been nonstop in terms of ideas, thinking, thoughts, and we went skiing together, and in Verbier, he invites a bunch of friends to go skiing once a year, and he invited me and my wife out, and on the back of a napkin, we basically said, hey, let's kind of go for it, you know, and that's what we did.
So you're opening next October.
That's right, October 26, 2010.
And let's make sure we get the name of the restaurant precisely, because...
It's Barbacoa, spelled with an E, B-A-R-B-E-C-O-A.
Okay.
And it's going to be right near St. Paul's Cathedral, a place where it's a great tourist spot, so it's a great place to know that you can go get some good old barbecue, and it's going to really burst onto the scene, don't you think?
I think so. I mean, they haven't seen cooking like this, and it's more than just, it's definitely not American barbecue. It has nothing to do with what Daisy Mays, which is really a kind of a showcase of American regional barbecue. This is really cooking with fire and cooking with coal and cauldron cooking and wood-burning tandoors and wood-burning Argentinian grills and really just...
Oh, did you read that book, Seven...
How brilliant was that book?
Oh,
I mean, Malman, he's a genius. And it's just, that book just spoke to me.
I was so sorry it didn't do an American... book tour, but anyhow, the photography.
Oh yeah, but it sold beautifully too. My goodness.
Yeah, and the photography won an award at IACP.
Oh, brilliant.
Well, now there are some interesting tips in this. Let's go back to BBQ25. Mm-hmm. Let everybody know that if they can't be bothered cooking it on their own, they'll be able to get it from you in New York.
Yeah, that's right.
In New York or in London. One of the things I found very interesting in your recipe for burgers, you put in a small amount of water.
That's right.
Explain.
When you're mixing the burgers, it takes away a bit of the binding effect, and it makes it a bit fluffier. It changes the texture.
Okay.
Now, is it just cold water? I had heard of ice water, added ice water before.
I haven't specified ice water or not. It was just something that I had picked up a while ago when I was talking to Jeffrey Steingarten, who's a food writer.
Oh, I know Jeffrey.
Yeah, he had mentioned it, and I said, huh, that's interesting, and I started playing around, and I was like, huh, he's right.
It's interesting because the Loeb brothers, you know them if you're in New York, of course.
Uh-huh.
We have their cookbook, and they're, of course, butchers to the stars.
Right.
Not surprisingly, since they have to pay the rent on Madison Avenue.
Yeah, with the prices, they're butchers to the stars.
Yeah,
but their instructions about forming burgers were move the meat as little as possible, touch it almost as little as possible, just to make the shape out of it, but try not to disturb it too much while you're
right.
doing that.
Right. And that's particularly the case, especially if you're seasoning the meat without, because if you start to work it, the chemical reaction of the salt with the meat is going to create a binding effect like you'd find in a hot dog.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So
I'm cooking veal burgers tomorrow night according to Loeb's recipe.
Yep.
Should I put a little water in anyway?
Absolutely. It will help the texture. But, you know, see for yourself. You know, put it in one. I mean, you know, you're going to be making a bunch. Put some water in one and do it with the out and choose for yourself. I think you'll have success with the water.
Now, are there any similar tips to that? I mean, I think I'm a pretty good barbecue cook.
Well, you know, for me, with grilling hamburgers, I do the griddle grill method, which I think is really important. I'm all about the crust, and that crust is what delivers great, great flavor. But also you get a very, very unique and very special barbecue or grill flavor from being over the fire. So the grill rods typically don't get hot enough. You can get a couple of grill marks, but I want that real crust. So what I do is I start the burger on the griddle, okay, with a little bit of whole butter, because that whole butter is going to intensify the caramelization from the milk solids. Then take that burger, then transfer it over the grill. So you kind of get the best of both worlds, and then also it will be guaranteed nonstick.
Yeah, well, you do that with chicken too, don't you?
Yes. I use the griddle on the grill a lot because those flavors have no place to go. So normally when the flavors just kind of fall through the grate, it's a place to intensify flavor and also get the same experience that you would get over the coals, but you get to intensify the flavor.
This is a man who knows his barbecue, listeners.
Yeah,
so
yes,
if you're a barbecue man or woman for that matter,
that's right.
BBQ25, the wonderful board book you'll never destroy, is going to give you...
I haven't tried to destroy it yet, but, you know, maybe I'm going to have to kick it around the room.
So. Well, we can give it to our toddler grandson.
I was inspired by my children, too, amongst other people. Yeah.
There you go. Now, it's not quite in the class of Ad Hoc at Home or John Foss's latest book, which are also useful for making brick chicken.
Yeah, exactly.
How much does Foss's book?
It weighs about 15 pounds, I think.
15 pounds?
And, oh, my Lord.
And I told Thomas Keller when we interviewed him a couple of weeks ago, I said, this is not only a very useful book for cooking, but it's perfect for making brick chicken. And he laughed.
No, he's brilliant.
If you get Thomas Keller to laugh, you've come a long way.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, you don't take yourself too seriously. I'm delighted to hear Adam Perry Lang, and we wish you wonderful success with Barbacoa in London, and we'll see you next February.
We're going to see you there, yeah.
Oh, please come visit me.
Oh, we will.
We definitely will.
Lovely.
And in the meantime, we hope that it gets off to a rousing start, which I'm sure it will. And maybe we'll even catch up with you in New York at Daisy Mays.
Oh, that would be lovely. Let me know when you come in.
Right.
Thank you so much.
Okay, take care.
Thanks, Adam.
Bye. Bye-bye.
So there, and hang on while we take a short commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome. come back, and who's up next then?
Yeah, well, actually, this is a most esteemed, admired, and beloved chef, food writer, Grace Young, who mixes a little poetry, a little philosophy, a little spiritual insight with recipes. And she's going to tell us all about stir-frying in her new book, Stir-Fry.
Peter doesn't usually get to kick off interviews, but I'm going to steal a little bit of Anne's thunder here, introducing our guest, whose email address is wisdom@graceyoung.com.
You were dying to get hold of that one.
I think you got the picture, listeners. We have a real-life expert on the line. And Anne, you can take it from there.
Well, I mean, no less a major culinary figure than Betty Fussell. That calls Grace Young the poet laureate of the walk, which I think is, you must have been just thrilled to hear that, Grace.
I was absolutely, I just about fell off my chair when I read that. It was like getting the Academy Award for me.
Well, your book is called Stir Frying to the Sky's Edge, The Ultimate Guide to Mastery, with authentic recipes and stories, and it certainly is all of that. It's also beautiful. The photography is extraordinary.
We did all the photography in my home, in the living room. It became a photo studio for 2 months, and I did all the food styling.
Oh, yeah, we're set to interview somebody who just wrote a book on food styling. Yeah.
And must be Dolores Custer.
It is.
How'd you guess?
How'd you know?
There's only one food stylist who's coming out with a major book right now.
Yeah, well, that's Dolores Custer. I've lived through a number of food shoots. It's not my most favorite part of the culinary world. It goes on forever, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's grueling work, but the photography in this book is exceptionally beautiful.
It is.
The photographer was amazing. I'm so happy.
Well, tell us about this book. I mean, it's not just a cookbook. You explain equipment thoroughly. You discuss techniques thoroughly. And then you also, you follow Chinese stir-fry around the world, interviewing people in the diaspora of the Chinese cook.
Yes. So I've been frustrated for a long time that stir-frying is a culinary term that is so well-known and accepted in this country, and yet people really don't know what stir-frying is. And when they're doing it in a home kitchen, I think most people are really frustrated with their results. They stir-fry and kind of they get this braise and the meat isn't really browned, and they don't really know what it is that they're doing right or what they're doing that's wrong. So I really wanted to write a book that explain the range of how sophisticated a stir-fry can be, but also to address the do's and don'ts of what you need to do when you're stir-frying on an American stove.
So yeah, that was interesting. I never realized that.
I think people, first of all, put too much food in their, whether it's a wok or a skillet, and so it crowds it, and so you never have a chance of really the food's browning, or there's so many vegetables that the vegetables on the bottom are burning, the vegetables in the middle and the top are raw.
And they also have the wrong kind of wok, right?
Right. And I think the type of pan that you stir-fry in is absolutely critical, and so many recipes are written for a nonstick skillet or a nonstick wok, and
right.
That is sure to give you a non-stir-fry. So if you want to be really authentic, you need to buy a 14-inch carbon steel wok, and I prefer the flat bottom, which has been modernized so that it can sit on an American electric stove or gas stove and get hotter. If it's the traditional round bottom, you put it on a ring, and that sets it too far from the heat in general to get sufficiently hot.
I'm sorry, Grace. So one of the things you have to do is you have to make sure the wok gets hot enough.
Exactly. But the second thing I just wanted to address is I know a lot of American home cooks aren't comfortable cooking with a carbon steel pan. They're not used to cooking with something that could potentially get a little rusty.
Yeah, but that's what happened to mine.
Right,
mine got tossed.
I encourage people to do it. Yeah, but it's like cooking in a cast iron skillet. And in fact, in the book I talk about the fact that it's the most natural way to get dietary iron, that you shouldn't be scared of a pan that could rust, because in fact, it's a good thing that there's iron in your pan. And the second thing is it actually creates what I call ancient nonstick cookware. The more you cook with it, there's a little oil patina that's formed on the metal, and then you use less and less and less oil whenever you cook, whether it's stir-frying or pan-frying. But for those cooks who are uncomfortable still with that, I suggest a 12-inch stainless steel skillet.
Well, you know, I'm glad that you brought up the dietary aspect of it, because for years, because I have all these cast iron skillets and whatnot from my mother and grandmother, and for years, like when I was pregnant, I had like one of the highest hemoglobin counts that that my obstetrician had ever seen.
No, I don't think that was the black bands. I think it was your diet, which is rich in lots of things with iron.
No. There's a dietitian that I interviewed in the book, and she talks about the fact that she's vegetarian, but her hemoglobin levels are super high, and it's because she's been cooking in a carbon steel wok all these years.
Let me ask you one question before we get off the subject of wok maintenance, because
sure.
you have a lot of information in the book about how to season your wok properly, but are you supposed to oil it after use? I mean, we do that with our cast iron pans. We heat them up, make sure they're absolutely dry, the pan is hot, and then we wipe a little bit of olive oil over them. Do you do that with a wok as well?
I actually address that in the book and say that some cooks suggest that you do it, but I don't, because oftentimes people only use their wok maybe once every 2 or 3 weeks, and so I fear that the oil actually will get rancid. If you're using your pan a lot, that would be fine to do, but if you're using your pan a lot, you don't need to be just adding that little coating of oil. So I think it's unnecessary, but there are cooks that do it.
Now, here's where the wisdom part comes in, listeners. You can you can tell that whatever there is to know about a wok and doing it right, it's in this book somewhere.
I'm obsessive.
Tell us about everything. Tell us about traveling on airlines with your wok.
So right now I'm actually on book tour, and I have my wok with me because, as I said to many people, I can't carry a laptop because I have a wok. It's 3.5 pounds carbon steel, and I put it in my hand carry because I'm afraid that if I checked it in, it could get stolen. And ever since the underwear bomber this past holiday, I used to carry my 20-year-old wok that had this beautiful black ebony patina. But now I carry a wok that I've been stir-frying with for about 6 to 8 months, and it has a beautiful teak patina. Still gorgeous, but the main point is, when I go on the road, whether I'm doing a TV show or I'm teaching a class or doing a demo, I'm doing a magic act, and I have to show people how it works. And once they see how incredible a carbon steel wok is, they get it. And it's so wonderful because a carbon steel wok is really inexpensive. It's about 1/4 the price you would pay for expensive cookware from Cafelon or All Clad, and it will last your lifetime. And when they see that you need very little oil to stir fry, and that the heat of this carbon steel wok just sears food like you cannot believe, and it gives us this unbelievable elusive aroma which makes a stir fry great. So it concentrates the flavor and brings out the aroma that is just, it's so seductive.
Now, this tells you, this book, all you want to know, of course, about the stir frying, but there's a difference to this book. You actually traveled and met with people in various countries and cultures where Chinese people had migrated to and modified their original classical dishes. How did you identify these people?
I was on this culinary detective hunt, and you know, sometimes when you're really wanting information, it sort of magically comes to you. So I was putting out a lot of feelers and asking people, and before you knew it, I found Chinese Peruvians, Chinese Trinidadians, Chinese Indians. It was really a fascinating story. And I grew up in a very, very traditional Cantonese home in America. So my ideas of Chinese food were very rigid. It was the same way my parents ate when they had been in China. So a few years ago, I found out about a Chinese Jamaican restaurant in New York City. And I had never considered the fact that anyone could eat Chinese Jamaican, or that there could be Chinese Jamaican cuisine. And the first dish I ate at this restaurant was jerk chicken fried rice, which was off the charts delicious. And I began thinking about the fact that the Chinese have ended up in some really unusual places in the world, and wherever they go, whether or not they have Chinese ingredients, they stir fry. So there's a very interesting book in the story about how there was a huge population of Chinese who ended up in the Mississippi Delta, and in the entire state
this is
of Mississippi,
true, yeah.
There was only one Chinese market, and oftentimes the families would just get to go to that market once a year to stock up on soy sauce or dried mushrooms. And they didn't even have Chinese produce until the 1940s. But it's a very heart-wrenching and it's a very touching story about how they made do with what they had and stir-fried with local vegetables, turnip greens, or salted pork. So one lesson I wanted people to understand in this book is if you live in an area that doesn't have Chinese ingredients, you can still stir fry. You can just take local vegetables if you don't have Chinese bok choy or Chinese broccoli, or even if you don't have ginger. It's a very adaptable cuisine and technique. I call it the chameleon stir frying.
Tell us about chop suey.
Well, chop suey is a fascinating story. My whole life, it's always made me cringe. I feel really like it's a Charlie Chan style of Chinese cooking that bears no connection to real Chinese food. But in doing the research for this book, I realized that, in fact, without chop suey, the Chinese would have never been able to survive in this country. And beginning in the 1800s, when the Chinese came to work on the railroads and the mines, there was tremendous prejudice against the Chinese. And in fact, in 1882, there was a law passed that barred Chinese from entering this country that lasted really until, it really wasn't truly lifted until 1965. Yeah, so this period that the Chinese are in America and after the railroads and the mines, the only jobs open to them were in the restaurant business and in the laundry business. But Americans started having an addiction for chop suey starting in the 1870s. And so in the 1900s, these Chinese families started leaving their Chinatowns in San Francisco and New York and going across the country and opening up chop suey houses in little towns and cities across America. And they were able to eat out a living because Americans had this love of chop suey. And in fact, it enabled Americans to be exposed to Chinese culture through these restaurants by seeing the dinnerware, how it looked different, maybe the decor, maybe the hostess was wearing a Chinese dress, maybe they were playing Chinese music. And in fact, now there are 40,000 Chinese restaurants in this country.
Wow.
But that initial chop suey lured America to try Chinese food, and over the years they got more and more comfortable. But to address what chop suey is, it is traditionally bean sprouts, celery, onions, sometimes bell peppers, canned water chestnuts, stir-fried with thick slices of either chicken, beef, pork, or shrimp, and there's always this kind of goopy sauce,
yes.
Lots of sauce with soy sauce, and everything is overcooked. So for someone who's Chinese, we cringe when we think of chop suey because it's not a stir fry. There's no delicacy. There's no concentrated flavor aroma. There's no ginger, in fact, is not even used.
Don't forget those noodles that came in a can.
Exactly.
What are those?
It's a sort of American concoction. It was concocted by Chinese living in America to satisfy what Americans perceived as being Chinese. But I have great respect for this dish right now because without it, the Chinese would have never been able to survive economically here.
Well, you put a whole new slant on a dish that I have reviled also. So, but it's very interesting, and I was really totally fascinated with the personal profiles, the personalities that you encounter in writing this book.
I'm sorry, Grace. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was very lucky. I met extraordinary people.
And, oh, they are.
Yeah. And I thought that I was going out there in search of great stir-fry recipes. But what I really learned through this book was not only great stir-fry recipes and all the little tips you need to know for ultimate success, but also that the stir-fry story really tells the Chinese experience about how they were able to survive by making the most out of very little. What a stir-fry is.
Yeah, that's, we have not mentioned that. Yeah, we didn't actually mention that. We should do that. Is the whole point of the stir-fry was it was for a limited amount of heat, right, and cooking time, and also...
Yeah, well, it's so perfect for our time because I think we're all watching our pocketbooks, and it makes the most out of very little. You don't need to have a big meat roast to make a stir-fry. It's just like a small amount of meat or chicken or fish, and it emphasizes more vegetables. So, in fact, it's a very healthy way of eating. But it also looks at our resources. When you're stir-frying, at the most, you're stir-frying, you're using fuel of about 3 or 4 minutes worth of cooking fuel, right?
Yes.
As opposed to making a roast or braise that could be a stew that could be cooking on the stove for 2 hours. So it's, in fact, a reminder that the old ways are really, we need to readdress how sometimes the old ways have great wisdom.
Well, I have a feeling that there's a flat-bottomed wok made out of carbon steel, it's in our future, since then threw away the round-bottom one that we already had because it had too much rust on it.
But Peter, I just have to interrupt you for 1 second. People get so nervous with the rust that you can always clean a wok, never throw it out. It will last you a lifetime, and even if you've neglected the pan for a year or two, I have a recipe in the book for cleaning it with salt and oil,
right,
and it will take away the rust, and you cannot kill this pan.
The trouble is it's already gone and already threw it. It's being recycled somewhere in the earth.
but I still have my knife that I would never part with. It's probably 40 years old.
You can't cook stir-fry on your carbon steel knife.
No.
So we're just going to have to buy a flat-bottom wok, and then we're going to have to start seasoning it, and we're going to have to do everything that's in this book.
Which is a wonderful book, and I urge everyone to get it. And it's on our website. People can get it right off our website. And do you also have, I'm sure you must have, Grace, your own website?
Yes, it's graceyoung.com, G-R-A-C-E-Y-O-U-N-G, and I am the wok doctor. If you have any questions, you can email me from my website, and I'm happy to do an email house call.
Oh, great.
Well, you're a wonderful lady, Grace, and thank you so much for calling us today, and we're delighted that you've been able to join us on the menu.
Thank you so much. It's really been a delight speaking with you and Ann, Peter.
Thanks, Grace. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. Happy walking.
And we'll pause once more
for a commercial break.
Right.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are again, and a most interesting woman, a most interesting discussion. Food styling. The woman is Dolores Custer, and she's top of her field.
And it turns out that Dolores Custer and Grace Young know one another very well. They know each other's work.
Good, yeah.
So that was fascinating. It seemed like a good idea to put their interviews together.
It's a wonderful, wonderful book, and let's just hear what she has to say about it.
Sometimes I think that the simplest thing for On the Menu to do is with Dolores Custer's book, The Art and Preparing Food for the Camera, called Food Styling. The easiest thing to do would be a quick comment that anything you ever want to know about food styling is in this book, and that's where you should go. Welcome, Dolores.
Thank you, Anne.
And it's true. It's just so packed with information. Tell us a little bit of how you had sort of an unusual course to getting to this point, right?
Yeah, I started out as an elementary school teacher.
Right.
And grew more and more fond of food and working with food and knew I wanted to do something with food but wasn't sure. I ended up teaching in my home, some cooking classes. I opened a restaurant, and then when we moved to New York City, I thought, okay, I think maybe it would be good to go back to school. So I went to NYU, and I was in charge of keeping our lab, the kitchen there, in order, and a product production company wanted to shoot a commercial, and they asked if I would help this person who was getting foods ready for the commercial. And I thought that sounded interesting, and I met a food stylist. Now, this was over 30 years ago, and as we worked together, I asked her all kinds of questions, and by the end of the day, I knew this is what I wanted to do. So it was one of those one day that changed your life.
Now, you've done so many things. You've been an educator. What are some of the different gigs you've done?
Well, I opened a school. I started a school for pregnant teenage girls. As I said, I opened a restaurant not knowing a thing about doing it and loved it.
Oh, I did that. I did that, too.
It's a huge learning curve, isn't it, Anne?
Oh, yes. I mean, I kept thinking, what in the world was I thinking?
Yeah. But once I started with the food styling, I must say that I loved the career. And every day is different. You work for yourself. Most food stylists are freelancers. There are a few companies that hire a full-time food stylist with them, and Gourmet used to have a full-time staff that would style their food.
But you
but
now are the
freelance.
Best of the best. I mean, you've worked for all the top companies, Kraft, General Mills,
mm-hmm.
Unilever. I mean, just one right after the other. You've taught at the Culinary Institute of America. You really ended up not just having a career, but being at the top end of the whole career of food styling.
Well, thank you, Anne. I think what happens is if you love what you're doing and you have been given a few skills, and I think the art skill is really important, but one of the things that I tried to do in the book, I wanted that book to be as thorough as possible, and you seem to have noticed that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you even get down to
all the teaching that I've done.
Okay, you get down even to, like, the size and shape of a kiwi if you have to shoot it.
But, I mean, doesn't it almost go without saying that if food styling is what you do,
mm-hmm.
then undoubtedly you are going to be, shall we say, somewhat precise in what you do. So the two things sort of go together. So
we're kind of strange birds. I mean, when we go shopping, we shop totally different than you would when you're shopping for yourself for groceries. We're looking at the size of the lemon, the texture on the color of the skin, wanting no blemishes. We're hoping that the skin will be just the right thickness when we slice into it. You know, and we get to know by the feel of that lemon whether it will or not. And, we're kind of strange that way.
Let's take a step back for just a second. For the totally uninitiated, and I'm semi-uninitiated when it comes to to food styling, although Anne's spoken to me about it, and I know it exists as a profession, and in any of it, I've seen it in your book. But explain, for listeners who don't know what it is,
okay.
Can you give us a 30-second explanation?
Okay. Food styling is like a makeup artist. We get foods ready for the camera, and we have those foods looking beautiful when the camera is ready to shoot them. And we shoot for magazines, cookbooks, we do ads, we make television commercials, and we shoot movies. Anytime that there's a camera there, we shoot it. And one of the things that I've seen recently that's, when I started writing this book, Peter, these people did not exist, food bloggers. Now there is a huge number of food bloggers out there who write about food and want to take pictures their food and make it look as beautiful as possible. And I was in Seattle recently and gave a workshop for 40 food bloggers for the day. And it's a whole other new world now.
So you're actually teaching people who would like themselves to be known as people who produce beautiful food and telling them how to publicize it best by taking really good pictures.
Right.
Wow.
Exactly.
Did you have Steamy Kitchen there? Was she there? The gal from Tampa? I think she was in Seattle.
Okay, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I didn't produce this. Someone else did. And I honestly wasn't able within that day to get to know or meet, you know, everybody that attended the class.
But you know, so many of them are, I mean, the photos are getting better and better and better, I have to say. I used to cringe at the photos because it's not easy photographing, especially in restaurants, if you're in restaurants.
Now, let's go a little bit further. Let's draw the distinction. I mean, when food comes out the hatch, in a restaurant like Thomas Keller's French Laundry or Per Se or Patrick O'Connell's in a Little Washington, two people I can think of immediately who are about the most precise. And you could probably add Charlie Trotter to that same group as well. What's the difference between what they're doing in putting out a very attractive plate and what you're doing?
Tremendous.
I felt sure there was, but I wanted you to explain
that. That's why he
asked you. Okay. Number one, they are putting out that plate to look very visually appealing, but also they're expecting somebody to eat it right away. When I put out food, I know that it's going to take the photographer or the camera crew or whatever a while to shoot my food. So I have to know how to present it in stages so that it's still looking alive and beautiful and wonderful when they're really ready to shoot.
But nobody, when you're done, nobody eats the end product.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes, they do. Okay.
And that's, there are certain foods I'd say no.
Salmon that's been sitting out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that can sit out all day and still look gorgeous. But there are other foods that die almost immediately, and so that's why we do things in stages. But I worked on a cookbook, and the food was so glorious. This was by somebody who used to cook for Jacqueline Kennedy. And the food was so wonderful that when we finished shooting it, we ate it. Uh-huh. So it was absolutely... Mm-hmm.
Well, but the other differentiation is that if there's a filter called the camera, which is very different from when you're looking at it mm-hmm. with your own eyes, mm-hmm. and you have to understand photography and lighting and all of those things, right? Angles?
Yes. I style whenever I arrange my food. Now, Charlie Trotter will... arrange the food so that it looks nice to the person sitting at the table.
Right.
If we're shooting a hamburger at eye level, then I put that hamburger where I'm looking at it right at eye level. And I arrange it so that it's beautiful at that angle, or if it's beautiful from overhead or whatever, because, yeah, I have to know the camera angle before I start styling.
Now, you've had some funny experiences. Could you just relay some of those? I mean, some... absolutely Herculean feats like the 200 pies.
Well, what I tried to do with the book is make it full of really important information, but I also wanted to try to make the book fun to read. And so at the end of the book, I wrote a chapter called Fun and Unusual Jobs, and the publisher was wise enough to throw those in throughout the book instead of making it the final chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I did things like I was spreading margarine in the rainforests of Mexico. I asked for 3 refrigerators, and they gave me 1 Coca-Cola machine. And we blew a fuse as soon as I turned on my hot plate, and then I didn't have a Coca-Cola machine either. And if you're in a tropical situation working with very meltable margarine, this is not a happy situation. So that would be one. Another time I was shooting a commercial, and we had worked very hard to make beautiful, perfect cookies all day long. And I went in to tell the director that we were now ready for that shot to happen, came back out, and somebody on the crew had eaten all the cookies. I call those my $10,000 cookies. It was about $10,000 a bite because we had to start all over and go into overtime.
Okay. We had an episode of that when a group of chefs were cooking at the Beard House,
mm-hmm.
and there was a meringue dessert that didn't hold up at all. But by the time we got it in the rain into Manhattan, but we didn't know about it until the next morning, at which point we had to start all over making 125 of them.
She didn't care. She was the calmest person I've ever seen. Andrea Schrenk. She just started making this thing called hippopotamus or something like that. She just started making it all over again, like it had never happened.
Yes.
I guess that's what we do. The show must go on.
Tell me this. I mean, I noticed that there are trends, and you covered this in the book too. The latest trend that I can see is a more natural kind of look of the presentation. Like here I'm looking at a piece of pie. It's just one piece left, and all the stuff is in the skillet. and everything,
mm-hmm.
and crumbs, you find cakes with crumbs everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Is this our current phase of food styling?
Well, yes. In fact, it's interesting to see the changes. As you said, I did the last 60 years of food photography and food styling as one of the chapters there, and the natural look is very much what's happening today. But I think it's beginning to become just a little more controlled now that because I see lots and lots of overhead shots, and that is sort of very graphic, very artful.
Oh, okay.
In the presentation, but Savoir magazine brought us the natural look. And a woman named Donna Hay in Australia. Both of them produced very beautiful shots of food, which were very natural looking, and everybody started taking notice. And we went away from the perfect to the more natural.
How do you expect that someone like me, who's interested in putting a good quality food product on the plate in front of my darling wife, who I cook for quite often. What takeaways are there for me in a book about food styling?
There are several. I think one of the least recognized things that's very important in making our food look good is the plate that you put it on.
Okay.
And that sounds real simple, but there's a reason that chefs use white plates.
Mm-hmm.
White plates make food look wonderful.
Right.
And I think that people who have very patterned plates, that really pulls away from the food.
Okay.
So that's one thing. I think doing little things that take seconds but add visual appeal would be things like that dish would be lovely with a taste of a little chive or scallion, chop them up and sprinkle them on top, and
okay.
That just makes it visually more interesting. So, and then think about, do you serve the food from the kitchen onto a plate, which is what I always did when I was at home cooking, or do you do it family style and have things in bowls and everybody helps themselves? But if you have, say you're doing the chicken, maybe putting the food around the roasted chicken rather than in separate little bowls, and use that as kind of a garnish and a beautiful platter presentation. So those are some little simple things.
Great.
Well, you know, Dolores, I have to tell you this picture of this pork head, the pig's head,
mm-hmm.
in your history.
Yes.
I mean, I was in a situation writing a cookbook for a private club,
mm-hmm.
Where part of the book was the history,
mm-hmm.
and there was one of the chefs had actually served a wild boar's head to one of the members.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so proud of it. And I had included in this book, and it looked just like this.
Yes.
So
yeah.
It's not necessarily a food selling success. Huh?
No, it's not so easy to make a roast suckling pig look beautiful. In fact, there's a really curious picture in James Beard's, one of his, I think it's on barbecuing or something, where there is a platter with a roast suckling pig on it, stuck up in a tree. It's not hard to find really, really bad examples from the 50s and the 60s.
I'm sure. Well, I don't know what you're going to do next, Dolores Custa, but I'm sure it's going to be interesting.
Well, you make me want to come back to Oregon and hang with you. You sound like a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Anne. Yeah, I am loving my new home, and I'm hoping to be out there teaching and helping other people, you know, have success with food. That's my goal.
Great. Yeah. Well, we expect to be in Portland later this year, so we'll look you up when we get there.
Please let me know. Yes. Okay. Look forward to it, Peter and Anne.
Okay. Thank you, Dolores Custer.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, she was so much fun to talk to that we just talked on and on and on, even after the interview was completed. I could talk to her forever. But at any rate, I won't, and it's now time to take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
I Okay, listeners, welcome back to the, for the final segment.
Can I do my little jingle?
You can do your little jingle.
Well, we used to have a little song that went, "Skinny Minnie, she ain't skinny, she's tall, that's all."
Oh, we did. And what that has to do with anything, I don't know.
Well, the next guest is the skinny chef.
I'm glad you didn't sing it. Please don't sing, Adam. Our son Adam used to say, "Please don't sing, Mummy." And if you heard it, you'd probably say the same thing. And you'd probably say the same about me as well. My rendition of Waltzing Matilda is somewhat admired, but most people stop me with "Happy Birthday." Anyway, the skinny chef tells her own story.
Jennifer, is it Easerlow.
Easy low.
Okay.
But it's not so easy to pronounce, right?
Right, but I forgot to ask you that, and I don't want to get it wrong. Jennifer, I know, because that's our daughter-in-law's name, and I could probably almost pinpoint your age on the basis that everybody born in a certain, around that time was named Jennifer.
All in the 70s. It was a very hip name back then. Yeah, you're so right.
Well, now, how did you get to be called the Skinny Chef? We're going to be talking about your book, which is Secrets of a Skinny Chef, but you're called the Skinny Chef, aren't you?
Yes, and it's kind of interesting how that started. My husband was the one who actually invented the name, and one night we were talking about my work when I used to work in restaurant kitchens, and all the guys used to tease me because I fit so nicely into small areas because, you know, kitchens in Manhattan are very, very tiny, so it's a real premium on space. So they'd always say to me, like, You're such a skinny chef. And so when I started to private chef for families in Manhattan, a lot of the families there wanted me to prepare healthy meals that I cooked for myself. And since I used to have weight issues.
Yeah, I was wondering, how fat are you?
Oh.
I was 40 pounds more than I am now. And it doesn't seem, when people see my photo, they say, oh, you weren't that bad. But, you know, according to medical and government standards, I was obese.
Good.
So, as a teenager and young woman growing up, going to college and living in Pittsburgh, being overweight was really hard on my self-confidence. And I feel like I missed out on so much of my life because I didn't feel comfortable in my own skin. I didn't want to date. I remember wanting to go out for the school play, but I was too embarrassed because I had these weight issues. And it was about looking good, but it's also about feeling good.
But somewhere along the way, you made a transition, because otherwise you wouldn't have been skinny in the New York kitchens.
That's right. And I think I wouldn't have had the confidence or the chutzpah to really be able to walk into a kitchen where it's all men. It's a very tough climate, and you have to be pretty gutsy. And I, losing weight and getting, you know, control of my health was one of the ways that I was able to have pluck up the courage to go to culinary school and do all the great things that I've been able to do over the last 7 years. So
let's drill down into this in book, which has in it not only a lot of recipes, but also a lot of tips.
Right, and they're the skinny secrets, and that, because everyone says to me, what's your secret? And I was like, there's not really one hard and fast rule. It's not a pill that you take, it's not a bad diet. It's about making simple and small steps to your everyday life. And when you do that, it's so manageable, it's easier, and it just becomes a part of a sustainable, healthy life. So some of the tips range from how to zest a lemon to make flavored water without getting extra sugar or artificial colorings. And some of the tips are just like simple things, like how do you order out in a restaurant, or, you know, if you're having trouble losing weight, maybe it's just one thing that you're eating every day that's keeping you from losing those 10 pounds you've always wanted to lose. Call that the repeat offender. So the tips are really things that you can take away from the book and use in your own kitchen, use when you're out and about, and to improve your everyday life.
But the taking out, probably your advice on taking out from a restaurant is just one word, don't.
Limit. You know what? I eat out twice a week. I love it, and it is my outlet, and it's a way for me to socialize, and I work out of my home, and, you know, when I work at home and stay at home in the evenings, I get to go out twice a week and meet friends and hang out with chefs I used to work with, and it's my entertainment, but twice a week is good, and then when I eat out, I always order a vegetable, plain vegetable salad with a wedge of lemon, some steamed broccoli. Broccoli rabe is in season now. It's delicious. Sauteed with a little olive oil and garlic. And then I have my treat for the main courses. I usually don't eat the whole main course, though. So, you know, the portions are so large in restaurants. But my husband always helps me out with that.
I have one of those, too.
Yeah, we're universally called Mikey. give it to Mikey. He eats everything.
Oh, Mikey likes it.
I'm Mikey because I eat everything that Ann leaves. Well, most of it anyway. Now, you've got a sort of a handful of ingredients, I think, that are particularly important to your cookbook. I'm thinking of things like low-fat dairy products. So
I'm
you want to just go down...
Yogurt. That's one ingredient you'll see time and time again, because it's one of those things where you can make it creamy without loading up on fat. And essential to have those that are sort of staple go-to ingredients, because if you're cooking a lot at home, you want to make sure what you're making is tasty but also makes nutritional sense.
Yeah. Now, you worked with, in addition to Joy, you worked with Jessica Seinfeld?
Yes.
And what was she like? Was she funny?
She was wonderful. I feel so fortunate that I've been able to work with people who love food and are passionate about food, like I am. And I think that's what really makes my career my dream job. And, you know, working on that book was so marvelous. I've been a private chef for over 4 years.
Yeah, you have a very diverse background from...
And, you know, a lot of what I learned working with families I put into the book. And the book is really food for real people, and it's everyday people. And it doesn't matter if it's a celebrity family or a family that's not famous. Families want to eat good, hearty, tasting food. They don't want to eat diet food or spa food. They want to eat spaghetti and meatballs and meatloaf and regular stuff that everybody grows up eating, but they want it healthier. So that's really the focus of the recipes.
Now, you've got, in addition to the book, let's just repeat, the book is called Secrets of a Skinny Chef, and it's on the OTM bookshelf on our website, apart from a lot of other places as well. You've got a community as well.
Yes, I have a website, and that started out about 7 years ago. I was working at NYU at the Stern School of Business as an administrator before I became a chef, and I was doing everything from visas to, you know, planning the recruitment and planning parties, and, you know, my dream was really to work in food, and once I made the leap, and I left my job, a lot of my friends there, I had about 50 friends from NYU, they kept saying, send us emails, keep in touch. And I said, folks, I'm going to be way too busy with internships and cooking. So I started an online food diary, and that's how the Skinny Chef site was started. And every day I would write about my adventures in culinary school. And more people were checking in, and then they started to ask me, you know, for tips. And it started out really as just a way for me to talk about my passion with food, and then it turned into now a resource where people can get all sorts of things. They can read the blog. There are free recipes. I have a podcast on there where I'm talking with my granny about old-fashioned recipes and how she grew up and how she learned to cook. So it's really become sort of a place where people, you know, can have fun but also get information about health.
And you say it's very popular. You have a lot of people, huh?
I do. And, you know, the readers write in, and it's so fascinating to see who's reading the blog. It surprises me. Sometimes it's a retired couple in their 70s. Sometimes it's a stay-at-home dad. I got an email the other day from a girl that's in high school that wants to become a chef. It's really marvelous. I'm just so thankful that we were able to start a blog and that I became part of the blogging community.
Now, and that website is www.skinnychef.com?
That's correct. Wow.
So join up, listeners, because if you don't have a concern that this book will help address, you're one of a very small minority of Americans, so it might be a really good thing to be a part of this community, and I think we're going to add it to the places that we look at regularly as well, aren't we, sweetheart?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, Jennifer, good luck with your book and with your site and with everything you're doing. You must have a lot of fun.
I do. It's really, it's been my dream come true, and I love the way people respond to my work. And so every day when I wake up, I'm like, I can't wait to see what's in my email or what I'm going to cook today. It's really been wonderful, and I thank you so much for having me on the show today.
It's been a delight, and keep us posted on any further future ventures.
Please give your Mikey regards from this Mikey.
Oh, certainly. Willie will love that. He's 6'5" and 180 pounds, and he's an eating machine.
He's just like Mikey.
luckily for me.
Yeah, it's like Peter. It's true. Oh, dear. All right, then, Jennifer. Thank you very much.
Thank you both. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's it, listeners. That's on the menu for another week. We hope you'll rejoin us same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.